had it discussed and had it voted down, and then you could bring forward a somewhat different solution to the same problem. So that this was an area, too, where this matter of having a staff that was listening and very sensitive, and where we tried to really keep the atmosphere and the state of tensions and so on in mind. And I really do not recall the specific speeches you referred to, but obviously I did feel a responsibility in those sessions I was in, and there certainly were many times, or a number of times, when it seemed like the psychological trend was going the wrong way, and I would try to make the kind of talk that would change the trend.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently there was some result at some times there.
Big happenings were going on in the Security Council. The trusteeship was plowing away. I'd like to go back and backtrack a moment to trusteeship, if you don't mind, and ask you if you could elaborate more on the various interpretations of independence and self-government by the different countries.
I know that it was a very extreme issue, and I couldn't recall all of those nuances right now, because they were, you know, the French had a very definite view, the Belgians did, the British did, and certainly the Philippines did. There were various interpretations of what independence meant, what self-government meant, what self-determination meant.
Yes, I think the word self-government doesn't translate even into French.
No.
But do you recall how you resolved these difficulties to mesh together the declaration?
Well, we resolved them in the language that finally came out in the charter. That's really the resolution of them.
Yes,
that was another one of the instances where we had to resolve the language in all of the five languages, the wording. There were some of those times when we not only had to agree on an English language and then had to agree on how that would be translated into French and how it would be translated into Russian and Chinese and Spanish. And there would be arguments about whether a word in another language was the correct meaning or a group of words. And sometimes you had to put in, you know, almost an extra sentence in order to, in another language, get the same meaning coming across.
Mm-hmm.
There were situations like that.
Well, we've agreed that you all had to have some sort of superhuman energy to get through this conference.
Well, it still had to be human.
But to what extent did you feel a sense of urgency that the work must be completed by a certain time?
We didn't feel that, really. We I don't think there was ever any arbitrary deadline. We did feel that, that if you got exhaustion of delegations and then got some type of diversion of events in the world, that you could lose that moment in history and have no charter at all.
Yes.
We did somewhat have that in mind, which is, always true that you can always have an explosion of some kind of an event that can then make the preceding work just impossible to carry through. So we did have that sense about it. And in that sense, of course, too, a very far-reaching question, suppose we were still meeting when those atomic bombs were dropped in Japan. No one can say dogmatically that the effect would have been X or Y or Z or what. In other words, that was the kind of an event that could change the psychology, the thinking, the outlook of people all over the world. Another interesting question there is, if the delegations were still working on the draft, would the bombs have been dropped when they were dropped? Nobody knows that one.
No.
You know, there was internal argument inside the U.S. government about whether or not to drop them or where to drop them.
It was really a very close thing, wasn't it?
The charter was signed in June.
Yes.
And these were dropped in August.
Mm-hmm.
It was very close.
Well, do you think if the delegates had had the knowledge, not that the bomb had been dropped, but the knowledge that the bomb had been developed, do you think this might have changed the outcome of the charter?
It might have, but I don't think anyone can say.
No, of course.
That's the kind of thing that, you know, and realistically, as I say, we certainly wanted to press to try to reach the point of an agreement. And, but to put it another way, and it isn't really very pleasant even to talk about it, you know, if some head of some major government had been assassinated right in that period, that's the kind of thing that could have just blown the whole thing apart.
And sky high.
You'd have to start again in other periods of history. So that it was fortuitous that we pushed on through and actually got the signatures when we got them.
You touched this morning on charter review, but is there anything else that you can tell us about your own involvement in behind-the-scenes activities before Article 109 was adopted?
Well, we drafted an idea for it, and then it went through a number of changes. But it basically was to try to make it clear and more practical to have the potential of a rewriting of the Charter. That was what was behind it. And it was discussed a lot about what its wording should be and how it should provide. I think it finally came out that it would take a smaller vote at a 10-year period or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That was a kind of a compromise of different viewpoints on it.
Was it not on that item that the delegation gave you sort of freedom of action to work out the terms in debate as you felt, as you saw fit?
I don't remember that particular part. I remember that I was, in effect, responsible for handling the item. I don't believe I was ever given freedom of action. We almost always all worked with the matter of reporting back before you finalize something.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom to explore, maybe,
yes.
But not really to bind. No, I don't think anyone was ever given freedom to bind the delegation without coming back with it.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure that was always our working method.
What about terms of withdrawal and suspension? Were you
those went through a lot of argument and debate and so forth in the matter of expelling and suspending and all of that. And I really don't recall all the different nuances of that one, but I know there were many different views and it was a rugged issue.
Well, thinking about the charter and it's having been finally drawn up, despite a lot of long, hard work and debate and dissension, which section of the charter do you feel the most proud from your own contribution?
I've never really thought of it in those terms. I think I think my view always has been as to the totality rather than as to any certain section.
Well, then how would you assess the contribution, not only of yourself, but your colleagues, to the entire charter?
Well, I think the entire group that assembled from the 50 countries, I would feel that obviously the greater judgment has to occur after a much longer passage of historic time. But I think it was a very historic event, and that everyone who was there and joined in that final decision and all the governments behind them deserve a lot of credit.
Charter reminds me of preamble, and Dean Gildersleeve working on this. Did you work with her at all? Did you think it could be more finely written?
Well, I worked with her from a standpoint I think you'd find in the archives of the United States delegation a lot of different drafts and a lot of rewriting that went on. I think at one stage that she asked everyone in the delegation and every advisor to come up with any suggestions they had. And then I think she did a lot. I think she might have even turned to some of her own academic people to try to get it so that it would have a lasting meaning.
Speaking of academics, reminds me that I think you've always had quite an affinity and connection with Harvard. Have you explored your ideas with Harvard at all? I remember you did consult with them before you joined
before
the delegation.
Before I joined the delegation, I had in fact also had conferences up there before I went off to war on my foreign policy ideas. Well, one of the things I had done, which probably should be mentioned, on the 25th anniversary of the United Nations, I drafted practically a whole complete new charter, and then it was requested and has been circulated quite a bit among governments and study groups and so forth. It would have to be redrafted again now with the passage of time, but in order that it would be more clear what I was talking about when I said that the United Nations ought to be brought up to date and made more adequate, I tried to put it all down on paper. So somewhere in my archives I have a new charter drafted on the 25th anniversary.
Well, what happened to it, though?
Well, it's bouncing around.
It's still bouncing around.
Mm-hmm.
Well, perhaps you should do another one. Not even waiting for the 40th, but it takes a lot of work.
A lot of work, and of course, it'd be more valuable by far if it's pulled together from a number of sources. It's hard for a government to officially lead in this matter. That's another part of it. Maybe somewhere somebody ought to bring together former secretaries of state and former foreign ministers of governments and get some kind of group like that together or something. Or
together with
some
educational,
together with some young people, or maybe different universities should start programs within their international relations studies to see what they think ought to be in a new charter, things thinking like that. I'm hoping, and I've been trying and beginning to, again, to try to stir up the thinking. And with the increased attention now to what a nuclear war would mean, there's a sort of a new rise of awareness of this. perhaps that can be in turn channeled to think constructively of how it should affect the United Nations of the future. I've often emphasized that it isn't enough just to say a nuclear war would be a terrific catastrophe, but you have to take the next step and say, how do you handle the affairs of the world so you decrease the danger of a nuclear war, or of any war?
Do you think that your experience at the conference was useful to you in your post-war career?
Yeah, we have never thought in those terms either. Most things in life have pluses and minuses in them.
A little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
You were appointed, I believe, Special Arms Control Advisor to President Eisenhower.
President Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm. And you were the U.S. representative on the U.N. Disarmament Commission
for
a few years, I think, in the 50s.
Mid-50s,
yes. Were they held in London, I believe?
Yes. Before that, there was the... I was the advisor in this field at the Geneva Summit Conference in 1955. And that was a very active period.
As we near the end of this interview, do you feel that there's some aspect that we've omitted and that you'd like to comment on?
Well, my main comment would be that I think that there's a current tendency to undervalue what the United Nations has accomplished and is currently accomplishing. That there are, of course, these swings of opinion, and that I would hope that those factors that lead to that undervaluing would be turned into an affirmative thrust toward this restructuring for the next generation. That's one of the things I would hope could be accomplished, is that the turn from negativism into positive approaches. And I also would say that I don't underestimate the difficulty of the United Nations functioning and being improved in the next generation. But I still have a fundamental optimism that, put it another way, I don't think bringing it up to position where it can function better for the next generation will be any more difficult task than it was to get it going in the first place. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
You see, that is, I think that, you know, when it came into being, then there was a tendency to discount the difficulty of getting it started. Now there's a tendency to magnify its present inadequacies and problems, and to exaggerate what it would take to get it improved. So that my emphasis is, let's get at it, know how difficult it is, but look upon it as something that just has to be done for all humanity on this earth. I guess that's about the most I can say.
Well, Governor Sasson, I'd like to thank you very much.
Well, thank you. This has been an unusual kind of a session, and I appreciate your thoughtfulness and everything, and of course, responded to the letter that asked me to participate. Many of these things I haven't tried to think of in detail for years. I might say another interesting thing. I saved all my archives, and they are going into a new World Peace Center within the Humphrey Institute out in Minnesota, University of Minnesota being my alma mater, and Minnesota Historical Society being involved. So some of the foundations have begun to put up some funds to, in effect, get a World Peace Center that centers on my papers and my views. And maybe that'll carry forward.
Well, you preempted my closing remarks about looking towards the future, but I think I get the feeling that you'd be quite ready to sit down right now with 140, 156 other governments to revise the charter, to take a new look at the organization, to set it going in a new direction.
To work with anyone who is like-minded to try to contribute toward world peace.
World peace, that's a good word to end on, I think.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think this is going to be a most invaluable contribution to our oral history program.
And as I indicated in the written paper, I don't put any restrictions on its use in whatever way. And in fact, you know, if out of it, as anybody reviews anything of this, they want to, any responsible person wants to write me and say, why did you think this, or what about a different idea here? I'm constantly in a more or less world correspondence about these things, and, and welcome it.
Well, I'd like to see you on something like the McNeil Lehrer Report. What about that? Who's acting as your press agent?
Well, I've been there at times.
No, so
maybe
recently,
I'll get back there again.
With these new ideas.
With the new, also the new attention now to what a nuclear war would mean. You know, what it would mean hasn't changed for the last 25 years, but currently it's a higher level of public attention on that issue.
Well, I saw something on television last night that said that there was going to be new educational material for young people in schools about trying to, in a way, get them not to fear so much the bomb, but to try to think of how they could prevent it.
Yeah.
And I think that the ideas that you set forward could very well fit into that. I wish you luck. I really hope that you can get going on all levels.
Thank you. It's been very nice to see you.